You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
Remembrances like a polluted beach, a graveyard of mermaid dreams, swept up by the fire I used to preach. Cassandra Mark II, the scapegoat for your ego. They wouldn't listen to the truth of the traitor incognito. Coming out of a cold, fast darkness, moving in, creeping closer now. Once adrift on a rotting carcass, sorcery, a deed most foul. Ariel is his eyes and ears, watch out, he can take you down. Over now, Prospero, where did you go? Is it set in stone? Is it over now?
Was a lovely Lindsay Gold with The Resurrection of Prospero, and you're listening to the Stone Tapes. I'm Sam Stone, and in the studio today we have with us David J. Howell.
Oh no, you're not.
Alex Lefchuk.
Hello.
We're actually letting him talk today. And we're sadly missing George Mann today because he couldn't be with us, unfortunately. Oh, yeah. But on the phone we have the gorgeous Patricia H. Ash.
Hello.
Hi, Patricia.
What does the H stand for?
Hi.
Hottie.
Hottie, apparently.
There we go.
Although, considering how cold it is here, it's more like hot cocoa.
Oh, so you're it's cold, is it, at the moment?
It is.
Really?
It's cold in Texas.
It's cold in Texas.
Yeah, it snowed here.
Really?
A few days ago.
Oh, that can't be possible.
Cold.
And is that a usual thing, or is this a bit strange weather for this year?
It's a bit early. It's usually not quite this cold quite this soon.
And you do get the full range of weather there, though, I assume.
Yeah, next week it'll be warm again.
Patricia, what have you got for us today in your corner?
Well, I went to the movies. And what I saw was The Man Who Invented Christmas, which should be in theaters now. It is over here. I don't know if it is over where you are. It was pretty good. It was pretty good.
Well, tell us about it. What's the story?
Well, it's about Charles Dickens writing The Christmas Carol, which he apparently wrote in about 6 weeks. Kind of made Christmas a thing, because it was before then sort of a minor holiday. And it's not Christmas until you see some version of A Christmas Carol. Mm. So, I guess this was my version of A Christmas Carol for this year.
So Dickens writing The Christmas Carol. Dickens was writing a lot for the pulp magazines at the time, wasn't he? So was that what he wrote The Christmas Carol for?
Not according to the movie.
Okay.
According to the movie, he kind of had this idea. He wanted to write a new book, but his publishers wouldn't go for it. So he got a loan and financed it himself. I'm not completely certain how much of this is accurate, but this is what happens in the movie. And it's really cool to see the creative process sort of on the big screen. Like, there's this part where he's sitting in the study and he's trying to think of the right name for what turns out to be Ebenezer Scrooge, as played by Christopher Plummer. And he's just going, Scrooge. And then when he gets the name, the character pops up in his study and they have a conversation. And that's, I don't know how you write stories, but that's how I write stories.
So they've kind of physicalized the creation of the characters and the story in the film.
Yes, they did.
How interesting.
And that was really cool to see.
I mean, the official line on Dickens's writing of the Christmas Carol is that it was also a complete, objection, if you like, to poverty. Does that come across at all in this story?
I would say so, yes, because they go into quite a bit of Dickens' own childhood.
Yes,
he grew up partially in the workhouses.
Mm, that's right.
So I suppose growing up in a workhouse would put you very solidly against poverty.
I think that was because his father was in debt or something, wasn't it? His father was in debtor's prison, if I remember rightly. Is that correct? And
Yes, indeed.
Yes, and then the poor kid ended up in the workhouse, basically, because he had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So what would you give this film out of 10, then?
I would give it a 7 out of 10. There's some problems with pacing, and the third act it doesn't quite live up to the beginning of the film, I think. It's still worth a watch.
Have you seen it at all, Alex?
No, but it's interesting. Dickens, of course, was a political journalist, and he turned to becoming one of the Victorian era's challenging journalists because, exactly as you've just said, his family was sent to debtor's prison. Mashalsea was the line, and it was something he kind of felt was wrong, and the notion of actually being sent to jail just for being in debt. We kind of view it as inconceivable now, but it was half the course in Victorian times.
And the reason, of course, they call it this title is because of the way he presented Christmas with the turkey, etc. Apparently it wasn't done until after Dickens wrote this story.
God bless us, everyone.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think I noted when we were planning the show, Patricia, that it's actually based on a book which is, as far as I know, a factual book by someone called Les Standiford, who was the guy that wrote the book. But it's not a fiction book, it's like a factual book.
Yeah, like a biography, basically.
And I'm fascinated to hear what you've said about how they've kind of obviously taken that factual, this is how he did it, and sort of physicalised it. I love that idea. I do wonder if that's what Les Standiford did in his book. Although it's a bit difficult to do that in a book, I would have thought.
Unless you're
novelising the fact or something.
I'm sure they've
really
done that to dramatise this, really, as a different media. I mean, to be honest, if I was a teacher now and I was teaching, Christmas Carol, which I think it is still on the specification at the moment, I would definitely be having a look at this film and seeing if it was in any way useful to my students.
Brilliant. I mean, it's such a... what's the word? Such an important text as well, and it's so ever-present everywhere.
It is.
And I'm kind of going to just move slightly off here because... did you see the Doctor Who, Patricia, that used the Christmas Carol for the Christmas episode a couple of years back?
Oh, probably.
The one with the flying sharks?
Yes.
In the mists? And the Doctor arrives on the planet and there's a guy and he has to save Amy and Rory in a spaceship, but the only way he can save them is to get the guy to actually change his character. And the Doctor does that by going back.
One that I've seen.
The Doctor goes back in time to meet the boy as a meet the man as a child.
That's right.
And show him what life is like. So it's like kind of like a twisted version of A Christmas Carol.
It really
basically.
Was. I remember that one myself.
Michael Gambon and Mr. Sardik.
It was.
Michael Gambon. See that one.
And a
Flying Sharks.
And the singer.
Catherine Jenkins.
Catherine Jenkins was wonderful in it.
In it as a
she
singer.
Was the best bit for me because I just love her.
So what have you seen any of the Christmas Doctor Who specials and stuff, Patricia?
I've seen some of them.
Yeah.
But that's not one I've seen. I think I would have remembered the Flying Sharks.
I think you would have remembered the Flying
Sharks. I mean,
obviously,
traditionally, they do seem to sort of. Utilise other media, don't they? Mm. We've had the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, for example, as one of the Christmas specials, which was a good one.
When there was another world inside a Christmas present. That
that's
the Doctor
right.
Had.
And
that's
trees.
Right. And trees.
Yes.
And
trees. And let's not forget the Titanic.
Oh, of course, the Kylie Minogue one.
Oh, yes.
With the
Titanic. Oh, yeah.
I do like that one fantastic. A lot, actually. That's
and the first one. Regeneration with David Tennant.
Yes, indeed.
The Sycorax.
The Sycorax.
Yes.
And the Runaway Bride.
Yes, the first one with Donna. All of these things.
Yeah.
And, of course, in a couple of weeks now, we've got this year's Doctor Who Christmas special, Twice Upon a Time.
Oh, well, so there you go. It's the same sort of
thing. That's a nice play on
words.
Yeah,
I like that. Twice
and of course, we've got David Bradley playing the first Doctor up against Peter Capaldi as the 12th.
Have we got Polly in this one? And
it has, yes. They've recast the old companions, Polly and Ben, who were companions of the first and second Doctors, in fact. So they've recast them. And I know nothing about really what the plot is here, but as far as I can tell or have been told or have seen, they do kind of remake some of the scenes from. The genuine William Hartnell's last story, The Tenth Planet, on a snowy, snow-capped base,
nice.
And
yeah.
with Ben and Polly and stuff. And we get to see the original Cybermen. So it's going to be quite cool.
And of course, this is when we get to see our Lady Doctor for the first time.
Absolutely.
What's your thoughts on that, Patricia?
I'm excited. I'm very excited.
Why?
Go on, tell us why it's such a good thing for you.
Well, first of all, I'm just excited about Doctor Who, and I'm also excited that it's a woman. It could either go very well or very badly.
Yes.
I think it's going to go very well.
I think it is, too. I'm feeling really quite positive about... all I'm looking for is, I think she'll do a wonderful job. I think she'll be amazing, because she is a great actress. I just want them to be excellent stories for her as well. And what about you, Alex? Have you got an opinion on that?
It's been said that Peter Capaldi is probably the best Doctor who's had the worst stories.
Yes, interesting.
That's a statement. A number of people are quite sad that he's heading off, but then again, they all do, after a fashion.
Last season was brilliant as well,
thought last season was one of the best we've had since the show came back.
Yeah.
I thought it was such a consistently superior run of stories.
Mm.
Different adventures. I loved Bill as the companion. I thought Capaldi was firing on all cylinders. I just thought it was a tremendous year's worth of Doctor Who we had for the last season.
Yeah, so you give a good actor some great scripts and look what you get.
Absolutely.
Fantastic drama.
Yeah.
You have a Doctor who's a spaceman who goes travelling. There's a cue there, Sam.
Yes,
there is.
Go for it, Alex.
Do we want to have a mark out of 10 for Patricia's Corner?
Yes, Patricia, did you give me
7.
A mark? You said 7, of course you did.
I said 7 out of 10. 7 out of 10.
Fantastic.
A spaceman came traveling on his ship. From afar, 'twas light years of time since his mission did start, and over a village he halted his craft, and it hung in the sky like a star, just like a star. He followed a light and came down to a shed where a mother and child were lying there on a bed. A bright light of silver shone round his head, and he had the face of an angel.
way from here, and I bring a message for mankind to hear. And suddenly the sweetest music fills the
goodbye to Patricia H. Ash. We're now joined by Robin Pierce. Hello, Robin. What's the view from your castle this week?
Good evening.
Hello,
good
Robin. Evening.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Mr. Berg wouldn't let me go there.
No, he wouldn't. He was determined to na-na-na to the very end. There you go.
So how are you this week, Robin?
Very well, thank you. Very, very well.
Good, 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 good.
And what have you been reviewing for us?
Well, I laid my hungry paws on the DVD of Shin Godzilla.
Oh.
Mm.
Now, I am a sucker for monster movies. Giant monster movies, even more so.
Absolutely.
I love Godzilla movies. I've collected them all. All. Right, even the really bad ones.
Yeah, there's been quite a few bad ones, as I recall.
Well, actually, that's a big bone of contention with me, because there aren't, Sam. What happens is that Toho make these films for the Japanese market, or made them in the 1960s. Mm. And what happened then was that American International Pictures picked them up, gave them a comedy dubbing, and sent them out as part of a cheap double bill for the drive-ins.
Right.
So the Western world's view of Godzilla is completely different from the East.
Mm. So what I used to love about the films, Robin, just going off the tangent slightly, was that when Godzilla's busy sort of destroying it, you always have a whole load of kind of populace running panicked towards the camera.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, some stagehand throws bits of polystyrene at them.
See, the thing is, Godzilla was actually a metaphor for nuclear testing in the 1940s and 1950s.
That's interesting.
Which caused mutations and radiation deformities and contamination in the sea. Japan, they have a fish-based diet. They were a poor country after the Second World War. And there were birth defects as a result of eating contaminated fish. And so Godzilla became this force of nature which was caused by radiation, and it was a metaphor for the whole thing.
Wow. Fascinating.
So where does Shin Godzilla fit into all this? It's presumably not a film about his lower legs.
No, it's not. Shin is a word in Japanese that has two meanings. It means new. It also means God.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. This is the first Godzilla movie from Toho since Godzilla Final Wars in 2014.
Right.
They killed Godzilla off in that. He met every other monster he had ever fought since 1954. And it was an epic.
Even Mechagodzilla.
Even Mechagodzilla.
I love
Mechagodzilla. Even the Godzilla from the 1998 Matthew Broderick movie.
Oh, I remembered that one, actually. Okay. I quite liked it.
Yes, it was a good monster on the loose movie. It was not a Godzilla.
But there was a Godzilla movie out a couple of years ago where you barely saw the monster in it. Was that the one?
Has nothing to do with that.
They were laying
movie.
Eggs in a theatre or something. I remember.
Yeah, but Godzilla sort of barely appeared.
The eggs in the theatre, actually, that was the Matthew Broderick 1998 film, and the theatre was Madison Square Garden.
Mm.
Yep.
And am I right that other Godzilla film, the one I was just talking about, not only did Godzilla barely appear in it, they didn't even use the right noise for him.
No, they did use the right noise for him.
Oh, they did? Okay, I must be getting very confused.
And they tried to make it larger than any Godzilla we've ever seen.
Right.
Toho kind of laughed this off because the Americans had got Godzilla all wrong. And they, in this film...
This is like their response.
This is their response. They have made Godzilla 10 metres taller than the American.
Oh, brilliant.
Which is fantastic.
That's genius.
So anyway, my Godzilla's bigger than yours.
Godzilla, yes.
Absolutely. This is the first time that Godzilla has been realised as CGI rather than the physical man in a suit. Although the CGI has been made to look like a suit.
Oh, good guy.
Okay. Yeah. It's Godzilla's first total reboot. You know, they've rebooted the franchise a few times over the years. But his first appearance in 1954 has always been regarded as canon. All the subsequent reboots have just ignored all the sequels and made it like, oh, this is the second time he's made landfall. You know, we're forgetting the, you know, King Ghidorah, the giant lobster, the smog monster, the slime monster, the plant monster, and every other monster. But this is his first true reboot. It's also Toho's 29th Godzilla movie.
Wow. Snap.
Right.
Yes. So, what do you give this, then, out of the usual 10?
Well, I would give this a strong 9, because it pays homage to the previous Godzilla movies. Godzilla makes landfall in an unrecognizable form. He's like a crawling slug destroying Tokyo. But through the film, he becomes the Godzilla we all know, you know, complete with his radioactive breath. Mm. And in A New Departure, he's able to fire these sort of same blue blasts from the plates running down his spine. It's a tense film. It addresses the question of how would the Japanese government handle an attack by a giant monster in this day and age, and what would the worldwide response be?
Which is, of course, what we should all be worried about. We should be thinking
about
this.
Well, absolutely.
Sort of,
but there is one country in particular. Bear in mind, this is a Japanese film, and I watched the Japanese language version with subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen the English one yet. They might have changed. One country in particular wants to nuke Japan.
I can guess which country that
is. Basically, I won't give any hints here, but they want to do it for a third time. And in an emotional scene, an actress has the line that basically she doesn't want to see a third bomb dropped in Japan, and to have to live through what her grandmother survived. So it's, you know, it's you're seeing it from the opposite side.
How fascinating.
Much,
that's lovely.
Much more than just a simple monster on the loose movie.
Wow.
It's well worth watching.
That's
right, well, hang on with us now, Robin, while we listen to a bit of Kate Bush, and December Will Be Magic Again.
Sings white Christmas. He makes you feel nice. December will be magic again. Oh, St. Nicholas up the chimney.
Lovely. And I was just saying, there's only Kate Bush that could make a gothic Christmas song, because everything awesome. She sings is just so beautifully
she's
gothic.
Absolutely awesome. And as it is Christmas, Robin, I believe you've got a little Christmas present coming up after this very show, have you not?
Well, as soon as I'm done here, my coat is waiting, the car will be turned on, and we will be speeding up to the multiplex for the midnight premiere of Star Wars The Last Jedi.
Oh, so, wow.
So which number film is that, Robin?
It's the 8th in the overall saga.
8th. Yep. So let's just put this in context, because, you know, I do get a little bit lost with all of these things.
Mm.
So way back in 1977, we yes. started with film number four in the sequence.
That's right, yes.
And then we went through 3, 4, 5, and they all kind of came out in
four, five, six
came out in the kind of the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
Then we kind of went back to the beginning.
In the late 90s.
In the late 90s, we did 1, 2, 3.
1, 2, and 3.
So which was yep. that? Was that? Phantom Menace was the...
Phantom Menace.
Phantom Menace was where it all actually started.
Right, so that was number one.
Yeah.
Right. And now, so that was 4, 5, 6. So we had 7 then.
That was
a couple of years
Force
ago.
Awakens.
2 years ago. That was The Force Awakens.
Force Awakens.
That's being double billed tonight.
Which we've just seen that.
We've just seen The
You've
Force
only
Awakens.
Just seen it.
We've only just seen it.
What, for the first
yeah. time? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We just didn't get round to it. I don't know why.
And to be honest, I absolutely loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we did.
I thought it was great. Mm. It was a great adventure film. It rocked through. I thought the characters were good. The story was nice. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great film.
I'm absolutely excited to see the next one. Mm. Now, Rogue One, I want to see
and
as well.
And was it J.J. Abrams?
J.J. Abrams directed Force Awakens.
Force Awakens, yeah. Because I said to Sam at the end, oh, it's J.J. Abrams. You know, you can't really go wrong with a J.J. Abrams.
What's your thoughts on that one, Alex? Have you...
J.J. Abrams, you can go wrong. Look at Star Trek Into Darkness. I won't say it anymore. Sorry. Sorry, J.J.
I salute you, sir. I salute you.
I liked it.
I like what he does.
I got lost in an Alias moment there, which obviously sent me off to a wonderful part of
it. I loved Alias as well. I thought it was a great series.
It did wander, though.
It did a little bit, but I loved it.
That's long-running series do, though.
So when we kind of look back at all of the Star Wars books, I don't really want to focus on the brand new one, Robin, because obviously it's brand new. People generally haven't seen it. I'm sure we'll talk about that in the next show.
Okay.
As the film and stuff. So looking back over all of them, it's quite an undertaking in a way, isn't it? To sort of, because everyone always said that George Lucas planned out all these films before he even made the first one. I don't know how believable that is.
I've got books on the making of Star Wars movies, and they've reproduced pages, handwritten pages in Lucas's spidery little scrawl, and he wrote an epic story.
Mm.
And he tried to get it financed, and people said, well, no, you've got about a 15-hour film here. You know, you need to just tell one story.
Mm.
And so he found that he could divide it up into 9.
Right.
And he concentrated on the middle bit, which was the most action-packed.
Right.
Because he had decided by then he was just going to make one film.
Right,
one little sci-fi movie that
because at the time sci-fi was very out of favour, wasn't it?
Very, very out of favour.
Really wasn't.
If you remember,
in vogue.
70s sci-fi, we rarely went out into space. Sci-fi movies in the 70s were the last gasp of the original Apes movies, Logan's Run, Soylent Green,
yes,
the Omega Man,
yes,
the Omega Man. We'd lost. The whole space-borne thing with 2001 A Space Odyssey.
That was 69.
Because that was 69.
Space was box office death.
It
was actually a box office failure when it was released.
And war, it was the last thing people wanted after the post-Vietnam scenario.
Yes.
People were saying in focus groups, we can't take a punt on a movie called Star Wars, it's insane.
Absolutely. First of all, the word war in a film apparently turned off the entire female audience.
Exactly.
Add to that a cast of unknowns, special effects that couldn't be done anymore because most of the people in the special effects industry had retired or died. So, you know, It was an incredible undertaking.
And a director who was so shy he could barely say a word to Alec Guinness.
That's what it was.
Well, his whole directing method, according to Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher, was at the end of every take, he'd say, great, let's do it again. Faster and more intense.
Man. But from that first film, obviously, yeah. he managed to get the next two done. So
yes,
it was a surprise success.
Erwin Kirschner for yes. The Empire Strikes
the
Back,
one.
Who was actually his teacher or his lecturer was it USC or UCLA?
I think it was USC, yes, yes. University of Southern California.
Spielberg went to UCLA, didn't mm-hmm. he? I keep getting them mixed up. Not the people, the colleges. He should have gone to the University of Lincoln.
It's amazing.
I believe they have a fantastic media department.
They do indeed.
Yes, they should have done. It's brilliant here. So, and then there was quite a gap after those first three. It was quite a big gap, wasn't there, before they went back to
it was all over, really, because they decided not to make any more.
Yeah.
And then
he had Indiana
they
Jones
decided
to do.
He decided.
Busy. Yeah.
I think after Jurassic Park that effects and CGI had evolved to the point where he could tinker with his original three films and add in the effects that he had seen in his mind's eye.
Right.
So he did that, and then he was going to release them all in 3D. He only got as far as releasing the
Phantom
Menace. No. I'm getting it all out of order. Then he decided he could make the first trilogy.
Yes.
And then he was going to start releasing the first trilogy in 3D, but he got as far as The Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. After that, he sold Lucasfilm to Disney.
Yes.
And this is where true genius kicks in. Apart from, I think, was it Roy Disney? Lucas, as part of his deal, is now the biggest shareholder of Disney. So technically, he sold Lucasfilm and Star Wars and Raiders to Disney, but part of his payoff was that he became the major shareholder and controlled the company that now owns all the people.
That's a masterstroke.
That's
you're
pretty
right.
good, isn't it? But that's actually Lucas's MO though, because when he did Star Wars, didn't he actually insist on controlling and maintaining the merchandise rights, even though at that time no one had a clue.
They were a throwaway, David.
Yeah.
They were an absolute throwaway.
Yeah. Mm.
And he actually got a good deal.
Yeah.
Because Fox thought that they were really taking him to the cleaners.
Yeah.
The only thing that Fox maintained after that film was the distribution rights.
Yes.
But now that Disney, since Friday, own Fox, they also now own all the distribution rights to the original Star Wars.
Do you mean to say we could actually have the official line where we have dun da 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 da, Lionel Newman thing can come back again?
Because, here's yet another part of trivia, that was re-recorded and rescored by John Williams for the original re-release. The special edition.
Mm.
It's so complicated, isn't it? It's so complicated.
Oh, it's fun to keep a track of, though. But think about it. With Marvel now owning 20th Century Fox... Sorry.
Disney
now owning 20th Century Fox.
And
they
Marvel.
Now own the X-Men
yes.
for Marvel, which they also own.
So we could have...
And Toy Story and Pixar.
So we could have a Pixar film... which includes the Star Wars characters and the Marvel characters.
Yes.
With Mulder and Scully.
Could have Marvel characters
with
in
Mulder
space.
And Scully.
When they do the second part of the Infinity War, which is due out in a few years...
Yeah. Is that the last
actually,
is that the last part, Robin?
That's the last right. part of the entire Marvel phases. They could actually have the X-Men and the Fantastic Four in the mix. Because all those rights have come back to Marvel / Disney.
With Mickey Mouse as the head honcho controlling it all from his secret base on the moon.
And the X-Men learning to be Jedis.
With the Nazis.
Absolutely. I'm back to be here. Come on, Tyson!
Fading joy and surprise. The Masterson, and you're listening to Sam Stone and Friends with the Stone Tapes on Siren FM.
And filling in for our much-missed George Mann this week is Alex with In This Month.
Well, huge shoes to fill, but one will do one's best, and hopefully we'll sort of take it through with a range of other factors. So, 79 years ago, it's alive! Marjorie Courtney Latimer, a curator at the East London Museum in South Africa, spied an unusual fish when combing trawler captain Hendrik Goosen's catch for specimens. December 22nd, 1938 was the date, and a 5-foot-long, 127-pound creature with fins that looked like limbs. It was determined to be a coelacanth. That's a coelacanth.
A coelacanth. Do you remember the coelacanths, Robin?
I remember a coelacanth in an Outer Limits episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
We have control of your radio station.
79 years ago, good Lord.
71 years ago, every time a church bell rings, an angel gets its wings.
Yes.
Best Christmas movie ever.
Oh. Yeah. Is that 71 years ago?
71 years ago, 20th of December, 1946.
Oh, I'm really
Frank
feeling
Capra's
old now.
Frank Capra's film, It's a Wonderful Life. Premiered in New York, USA, released on the 7th of January, 1947. Wow. And lots of challenges there when Capra was actually said, you can't do this, it's not going to work, it took a long time. It was thanks to television that It's a Wonderful Life actually became the cult classic It's become.
Wow. They showed,
James Stewart,
they showed
of course.
On television.
Onwards, because they didn't have to pay the rights. Disney didn't own it, always well with the world.
Oh,
let's go with that.
Wow.
There we go.
There is a classic line which actually used to use one of those whirling kind of silvery things which we all used to, I forget the name, it gave you all sorts of shapes and designs and it said, Jackanory. Yes, a kaleidoscope. First episode of the children's storytelling programme, Jackanory, went out on the 13th of December 1965, 52 years ago. What was it, Robin?
Cap of Rushes, told by Lee Montague.
Gosh, you know everything, Robin. That's incredible. That's astonishing.
Sort of thing.
Now, I obviously didn't see it in 1965. But I did see that later on, and I remember that story really.
Cap, you know, of Rushes.
Cap of Rushes. I remember that. I remember seeing it replayed on television as a child. So
just after The Jungle Book, and of course, he had all his challenges with Miss Travers and a whole range of other Mary Poppins things. Walt said, "That's it. I'm off to go into cryogenics." No, he didn't. He just passed away. The pioneering American film and television producer, Walt Disney, passed away 51 years ago in 1966, 50th of December.
December. Co-founder, of course, with his brother Roy, of that company that now runs Star Wars, Marvel,
and everything else, Starbucks.
But not the Stone Tapes.
Not the Stone Tapes. Not Siren.
Make us an offer. Make us an offer. Please, make us an offer.
Are we for sale? What? Christmas sale.
I think Robin knows some of the things Disney are responsible for in terms of the mouse and so on and so forth. So let's just go, wah! Why not Howard as opposed to Donald? But he owns them both now, so he could have Howard the Duck meets Donald the Duck.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
49 years ago, 3 days after the launch, the crew of Apollo 8, astronauts Frank Borman, James Lovell and William Anders, became on December 24th, 1968, the first humans to leave Earth's gravity and orbit the moon.
Wow.
49 years. Do you know, we have this concept of these things, and I'm always shocked in this section how long ago things were, because almost feels like yesterday in some ways.
I think everybody, well, not everybody, a lot of people probably know that we first walked on the moon in 1969. But I didn't realise it was only the year before...
They had to check it out.
...that the first humans left Earth's gravity.
They had to offer up a prayer as well. And as James Lovell actually said, the moon looks like plaster of Paris or a sort of greyish beach sand.
Wow.
They could have sunk. As Sir Patrick Moore said, they didn't know when they landed on the moon that they couldn't... They didn't actually stand.
I wonder when Yuri Gagarin was then. Because I thought Yuri Gagarin was the first man into space.
61.
So how could these people be the first humans to leave Earth gravity and orbit the moon?
The moon.
So Gagarin was the first man into space.
Interesting.
And Laika, of course, the Alsatian that we forget so soon. Actually, they use monkeys in the States. They haven't changed. Finally, 31 years ago, on the 17th of December, 1986, Davina Thompson became the world's first recipient of a heart, lung and liver transplant at a place not too far away from Lincoln, England, Cambridge, United Kingdom, Papworth Hospital.
31 years ago.
That's a massive advance for medicine at that point, wasn't it?
Oh, that's incredible. And then you look and you see that 1986 was 31 years ago, and that just doesn't seem right.
Mm.
I was saying only very same with Owen Paul, my favourite waste of time, who after 30 years has finally sorted out his legal ramifications with his team.
My word.
Just goes to show.
That's crazy. What do you make of all that then, Robin?
31 years ago, 1986, is when I met my then-wife-to-be.
Oh.
My life go.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing.
Truly.
You've never looked back since.
No, I haven't.
He says cautiously.
He says very cautiously.
End run, George, I tried. George Mann will be back in January. I did my best
did
on that point
well.
Of view. Quick, bring on Bowie, bring on Crosby.
Yes, you've got to have a bit of that.
King to see, ba-rum-pa-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-pa-bum-bum. Rum-pa-bum-bum, rum-pa-bum-bum. Peace on earth, can it be? And years from now, perhaps we'll see. See the day of glory. See the day when men of good will live in peace again. So peace on earth when we come. Every child must be made. place on earth can it be? Can it be?
Oh, I love that. That's just one of my favourites.
Voices are just like liquid caramel.
Absolutely. You've got to love Bing Crosby. I mean, I was torn this show whether to have White Christmas, which is a classic, and I do remember watching the film because I love musicals. And
but this one, you got David Bowie in
as well. Yeah, I love him, and it's so sad voice. That we lost him. So and it is a great bringing together of two different generations of music there. And
do you have
lovely.
A favorite Christmas song, Robin?
White Christmas for me.
Yeah it's a beautiful. Yeah. I was
what about
torn.
You, Alex?
Next year, maybe.
Do they know how Christmas trees are grown by Nina from the On Her Majesty's Secret Service movie?
Which you played earlier tonight on Saturday.
Exactly. Yes. Or last night if you're listening to this on its Thursday, actually.
Anyway, we're glad you've stayed with us, Robin, because we're now going to be talking with David about his film of the month. And what
My
is that, David?
Film of the month. Okay, so this is the Christmas show. It's going out in December. So we try and find a Christmas film. I think, seem to remember last year we did Gremlins. We have lots of arguments about Die Hard.
Yes.
But what we've chosen for everybody this month is a lovely little film, 1974, Black Christmas. Have you seen that, Robin?
I have indeed, and I have it in my collection.
Yes, indeed.
Have been surprised if you've said no.
I'm surprised if you said no. I'm sure George has seen it as well. Alex, have you seen Black Christmas, the original?
Yes, sometime in the times past, exactly.
So... it's a fascinating film, Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark, written by A. Roy Moore. It stars Olivia Hussey, Ken Dulia, Margot Kidder, John Saxon. And what's interesting about it is it is like the very first slasher film. 1974, we're before Halloween, we're before Friday the 13th, we're kind of pretty much before... just about every single slasher film. And yet those films I mentioned are often cited as kind of, this was the one that stuck, this was the one, this was the one.
That's right.
But what Bob Clark managed to do in Black Christmas is to create a film which actually invented and used first so many tropes that we now take for granted in horror cinema and in thrillers. It's a lovely film. It's very simple. It's a group of sorority sisters who are living together in a house, and it's Christmas, and they start to receive threatening phone calls. And the phone rings, and there's this guy telling them he's going to kill them and spouting all sorts of obscenities and so on and so on. And while this is all going on, of course, in terms of the viewer experience of the film, we know that there is a lunatic living in their attic who is coming down and killing these girls as the Christmas celebrations are going on. It's a very simple film, very simply put forward, but it's also a very frightening film.
Very frightening.
It's very well made. It's very creepy. It makes great use of Christmas carols and songs. I mean, Margot Kidder gets actually killed, stabbed to death with the horn of a glass unicorn while the carol singers are singing at the door. It's really very, very well done film. I absolutely love it. I think it takes its subject matter very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I think it presents it well. It's extremely well directed. It's very claustrophobic. The final scenes with Olivia Hussey, even watching it again last night, had Sam and I like screaming at the television screen, "No, don't do that. Don't go there. Don't go there."
Why would you do that?
Well, don't do that. Don't do that. But I'm not going to spoil it for people, because if you haven't seen it, it's well worth seeking out.
Interestingly, I think it stands the test of time very well. Mm. It didn't feel...
It doesn't terribly, feel old, does it?
It feels like it's a period film, yes, if you like, but it didn't feel dated.
No, it really doesn't feel dated.
It was interesting because it's really good writing, and I think that's one of the... And good performances.
What do you feel, Robin?
Well, I think it's got that period feel to it, and it hasn't aged at all.
Mm.
I don't think that audiences... I certainly hadn't seen anything like it when I first saw it on television. Mm. Since Psycho.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
You know, you were sitting there, you didn't know what the rules were. I mean, there are hard and fast rules for slasher movies these days. But this was before they became basically a cliché. So...
But it's a film that it almost wrote the rules. It almost wrote the rules, right?
Yes, it did. And... they showed you where the killer was, and yeah, the voice on the phone. I mean,
very creepy,
kind of haunted
insane.
Days. It was so well done.
Well, Matt, actually, we're running out of time, so we are running out of time. So I want to quickly ask you what your score of this film.
Oh, I think it's got to be a solid 9 out of 10 for me. It's a great horror film. Definitely one to watch at Christmas time.
Yeah,
and definitely worth seeking out if you've not heard of it.
9 out of 10 for me. What about you, Robin?
I will agree with you. 9 out of 10.
Alex.
I might go 7.5, actually. Okay. I'm more of a Dr. Fibes man. Really.
Well, we always love that.
I'm out of taste.
And that's all we've got time for. Thanks so much to Patricia H. Ash, Robin Pierce.
That's not Phantom of the Opera.
David J. Howe. And, of course, our producer, Alex Lefchuk. And I'm Sam Stone. And we'll see you in 2018. Isn't that scary?
Yay.
Have a good holidays, everybody.
Here's George Michael.
Christmas.